The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul, and I'm delighted today to be able to introduce the Stocks for Follow discussion with capital markets expert John Heumann. So welcome, John.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. Well, the markets have had quite a good rally, actually, over the past two or three weeks, which is largely on the back of sort of like declining inflation expectations and lower bond yields. But is this another one of those head fakes, another bear market rally, or is it more sustainable? What's your view?
I think it's a bear market rally. Of course I do. It's my nature. But and it has, you know, there has been some softening in the last few days, you know, particularly over in the US. And you know, I think the tensions, as you say, have shifted. Well, there has been this view that inflation is starting to moderate and evidence that inflation is starting to moderate. But I don't think it's gone away entirely. And I don't think we've seen the last of the interest rate rises around the world, particularly in Europe. And the UK as well. And I do think attention is now going to turn to the economy more than interest rates. Mm. And, you know, and we are seeing some signs that you know, there really is you know, a recession on the way, the degree of which is still up for debate. You know, a lot of people saying soft landing, a mild recession. But we've seen some horrible figures out from the US, particularly the Empire Manufacturing Survey, which was absolutely horrendous.
Did you see overnight, actually, the other Discovery Financial ones as well, who do sort of like credit cards to lower income families? And that came out with really high delinquencies. So their shares were off heavily, I think, overnight. So that sort of like fits what you've just said, actually.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a few signs. We're seeing, you know, slight rise in auto delinquencies over in the US. You know, we had some news, which we discussed last week, about the housing market. I mean, the signs are not that great. Jobs market's still strong. Mm. And this is where you get the sort of the dichotomy. You know, so with that strong jobs market and wage growth as it is, you know, the central banks are still, you know, their hand is still tied towards interest rate increases. But you know, we are seeing, we had some news from the recruiters, Page Group and Robert Walters, in the last week or so. And you know, they were pointing to very uncertain times ahead. So you know, I think, as I say, recession is where, and the economy is where people will start to look now, because it will impact companies.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And it probably impact margins, actually. I think it's probably one of the weak link, the sort of the Achilles heel, isn't it, of the corporate world, because profit margins have been going up for the last 20 years. And just by mean reversion, they come down. Now, I guess the sort of the next $64 million question then, John, is what you've been doing with your portfolio. You've been sort of like heavily going into cash, or how have you sort of positioned it on a sort of asset allocation basis?
Well, I'm still largely in cash. You know, I mean, I got lucky with my timing, as I've mentioned before. So, you know, I transferred a lot of corporate pension money into a private SIP. And just as I did that, you know, markets sort of towards the end of 21, markets started to roll over. And so I didn't deploy a great deal, and, you know, a lot of it. And so, you know, it's largely where it is. You know, I did buy what I thought was a value stock, which was BT, which has not proved such a value stock at all. It's proved a falling knife, a value trap even. I bought Unilever.
Oh, okay.
And that's done really well. And I think, you know, that sort of speaks to this idea around buying companies with pricing power, because Unilever, with the strength of its portfolio and the brands that it has, you know, really does have the ability to push prices up and hold its margins, you know, alluding to what you said about margins earlier. I bought Somero early on.
Somero,
I bought out a while back, and I haven't done anything with it. That's had a really good month.
What does Somero do?
Somero Enterprises. It's basically, they make machines for leveling concrete streets.
Oh, see, Somero. Okay, yeah. Yes, gotcha.
And, you know, it's a growth company, but looks very cheap.
Yes.
And, you know, even before the sort of massive derating of growth shares we saw across the last year, it was looking cheap. You know, the worry there is that if there is a big recession, you know, it is a cyclical company and it's exposed to, you know, weakening in construction markets. My thesis would be that companies like that, you know, even if there is a weakening sort of residential construction, you know, some of the sort of office type real estate, commercial real estate, it should actually start to do well if there is a shift towards infrastructure spending, which I think there's going to be, as a result of the economic weakness that we're seeing. I think infrastructure investments, pushed by governments, are really going to step in to sort of fill the void in the economy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Somero also do the leveling for a lot of the big sheds for the online, which had a great time. It might have a slight air pocket while things catch up, I guess, which is probably what's giving it more value, I suppose, in the share price.
I've had
a couple of sort of like one up, one down in my portfolio. When Equals came out with some fabulous trading updates, they do sort of Forex, sort of foreign currency services, international payments, and they're taking market share from the banks. And anyway, their shares, their revenue was up 60% like for like, and sequentially second half, first half up by 22%, increasing margins. So they're getting the operating leverage. So that was been a good one. But on the other side of the coin, I've been one of those with Boohoo. So I've been crying dull to the bank on that one. I bought it about £2.60, and I think it's bumping around sort of 45p. So I got that one big wrong. But
I'm not a big fan of the fast fashion retailers, particularly the online ones. You know, they had a massive tailwind. From the pandemic and lockdowns, and they had a tail. You know, it was just a growth story. But the thing that really drove it, as far as I could see, was cheap manufacturing, but also free returns. And actually, the economics of that industry, to me, just never stacked up. And so, along with sort of Boohoo's corporate governance issues, which was a real problem over the last couple of years, I don't like it. I'm not a big fan of very cyclical retail shares.
Yeah, well, you made a right decision there because it's lost me a shed load of money. What's quite interesting, actually, their trading update this week, they seem to have solidified their actual trading in terms of, yes, the sales on a like-for-like basis year-on-year have gone down, but they're still 35% up when they were pre-pandemic. And their sort of real problem areas have been the freight incoming costs and also the actual shipping out to the States, which has taken a lot. Effectively, they can't compete with a 10-day sort of lead time in fast fashion. And so they're putting RDCs out there. But I have noticed, actually, just on this, is something to have a look for with other people who, just any broad issue for, investors, the short interest on Boohoo, and you are probably one of them, I guess, but anyway, probably not, that's actually decreased. It was 10.4% in September and is now down. I mean, still heavy, it's down to 4.6%. So I think people are getting a bit more comfortable, but I'm with you. I think it's high risk. It isn't one of my sort of like better plays, but you've got to, if the business can actually come out of this in 2 or 3 years' time, it'll be a lot fitter and a bit lot more resilient than it was. Now I need to sort of pick your brains on the insurers, actually, or just one of them, Direct Line, and it basically came out with a trading update, I think, 2 weeks ago, and it's an income stock. It got absolutely battered, and largely because of things outside of its control, because of the cold weather, there's a lot of domestic burst pipes and problems in terms of sort of like, damage to houses and properties and stuff like that. So its claims ratio has gone up. And then it's had a bit of a perfect storm as well in terms of the sort of the car insurance, because they've had car inflation and lots of people have sort of been putting in claims for those, which again is higher than their expectations. And also in the summer, they had subsidence with houses because it was so warm. Mm. Now, what that meant is it was traditionally been an excellent income stock, and I think the shares are trading at about £1.75. And just to give you an indication of the income, since it listed 10 years ago, it's given shareholders £2.70 in dividends, so nearly a pound higher than the existing shares in straight dividends. So it's a big income stock. But the sort of like the what's good in insurers and an inflationary world is, with interest rates going up, then the premiums they get will generate more income for them for their investments. Plus, if it's an industry-wide issue, and obviously brands and stuff like that, and they have Direct Line, they have Churchill, and green flag in these sort of areas, then effectively, you know, those key players in that industry should be able to move prices up accordingly, because obviously you get more claims, then the premiums go up. And it's trading at a sort of like a, it's a sort of 7 or 8 times PE. I'll put it up on the, you know, actual conversation, but just really just top level. Is this a value trap, or is this a sort of like a value player? I don't want it to be like a BT, but.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really like insurance. You know, it's never been a sector that's appealed massively to me. Yeah. You know, mainly because, as you say, you know, it's often driven by factors outside their control. I mean, I've seen a lot of cars in ditches around Suffolk over the winter. It's extraordinary. But the other factor outside their control, as you allude to, is the sort of interest rate environment and their ability to earn on their investment book. Yeah. And it's just been really difficult for them for years. Yeah, it might change, but you know, I'd like to wait and see.
Yeah.
In that sector. And also, it's massively competitive. You know. Price comparison has allowed, you know, a lot of shopping around to get the best deal. And there's obviously regulation now coming in that means that, you know, that new, you know, renewals have to be offered at the same price that they're offering to you know, new customers.
Yeah.
And, you know, their ability to kind of, you know, make money in the way that they used to, I think it's been curtailed.
Okay, right. Well, I'll stick it on my watch list anyway. Is there any other companies you've been watching at all? Or in the last sort of a news flow? There's plenty on, the, obviously, in the healthcare side, which I'll just touch on in a moment.
Well, we spoke about healthcare the other week. And, you know, one company that I have had a dabble, and I say dabble, you know, not I've not gone in big, is H5O.
Yeah.
You know, I really liked it. Spoke to the chief exec. You know, it's profitable, certainly on the cusp of like, you know, significant profitability, does clinical research support essentially in infectious diseases. You know, it's a big area. You know, the pandemic may have had few silver linings, but one of them is that healthcare spending is on the up for investors. This is a good thing. And infectious diseases are a key focus of vaccines, obviously. So yeah, I think it's just in the right place. You know, it's winning big contracts. It's selling more to its existing customers. It's just got all the right ingredients.
What sort of multiples is it trading on?
I mean, I don't think it looks cheap on a headline figure because, you know, say it's really on the cusp of profitability.
Oh, okay.
However, you know, 29. So yeah, not cheap at a headline level. That's a forecast PE. But I do think the growth is there to support that rating. The other one I was really tempted to have a go at is actually a spin out from that company was Poolbeg.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean it's more actually on the drug discovery side of things, treatment discovery. Uses, you know, AI to support its approach. And yeah, I just really like looking at it. The share's up about 50% over the month. So
oh, okay.
You know, I bottled it and missed out, but you know, I do like it. I'm just always worried about those sort of, you know, small biotechs and the hit rate on new drugs. You know, there's every chance that a new drug doesn't make it to market. I think it's, you know, a 5% chance of success. I think from speaking to them, from looking around, they've got an approach that improves their chances. But nevertheless, I do think, you know, drug research is tricky.
Oh yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. You've got to sort of like, you know, play the odds, I suppose, to a certain extent. And there was one company actually that I'd been watching a great deal, came out with really unbelievably scientifically terrific data this week, was Avacta. And they basically said that their phase 1A trial data for their new pro-doxorubicin sort of chemo warhead, a sort of targeted chemo warhead drug, it not only met its sort of like, you know, its main sort of target, main goal, but actually reading between the lines, I think it surpassed it. And just give an illustration to sort of like investors about what this particular drug does. I mean, there was a guy actually I go swimming with, and he's 17. He's in a bad way. He's just been diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. Now, prodoxorubicin probably wouldn't do lung cancer, but it's a hard tumor. And so his only option is to do chemotherapy. Mm. And effectively limiting the amount of chemotherapy can do because of the side effects. You know, it sort of impacts your kidneys and your heart and all kinds of different conditions. Now, with this sort of like the precision platform they have, this chemo uses an enzyme that basically deposits the chemo onto a particular tumor. So what that means, and this is what the results have come through, is that the safety data for the pro-doxorubicin, it doesn't basically allow any of the chemotherapy to go into good cells around the body, but just deposits that chemo warhead onto the hard tumor. So what you get there, potentially, if this one eventually comes through to market, which would be a huge boost for cancer patients in particular, is that you'll be able to have a much higher dose of chemotherapy, which is proven over 30 years to be very effective, but you won't get the side effects of it. And that means that, you know, guys like this, they've actually got a chance of beating this disease, because, or at least extending their life, because it will shrink the tumors without causing the, you know, the sort of the side effects, which was what effectively limits the amount of chemotherapy anybody can take, you see. So it was fabulous. I mean, the shares were up 20%, but that really sort of, like, you know, when you come back to sort of how do you reduce your odds of non-success at all, having a drug that you already know and understand that for 30 years is probably a good way of doing that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, precision medicine essentially is what that is.
And, yes.
You know, I think the advances, you know, in healthcare, and a lot of those advances being driven by, you know, increasing computing power and sort of, you know, the integration with the technology industry, that's what we should be looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and when you... And it was funny, actually, because I interviewed the CEO, Alistair Smith, for the first time 2 years ago. And he's got so many different sort of, like, you know, potential shots on goals with the technology he has, with the prison technology and the Affirma sort of like technology he has. But he said his personal number one objective was to bring this particular drug to market, because it will be so beneficial effectively to mankind, not just in developed markets, but across the world, because chemotherapy is obviously is off patent, and so it'll be a lot cheaper. But anyway, I wish them all the best. But I think I'll just highlight it. It's terrific. I mean, this, you know, it's a terrific opportunity. This is a total addressable market of roughly around, if, you know, people, you know, $50 billion. I mean, it's enormous.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I also want to see in you know, that certainly pre-revenue drugs companies is a decent balance sheet, so they've got to have the cash there to take these programs, you know, through to that stage, or at least the stage where they can, you know, find a partner. Yeah. So, you know, having the money in the bank is definitely the thing to look out for. The other company in healthcare that I like, it's not medicine per se, it's more in the medical devices side of things.
Okay.
Is Intelligent Ultrasound.
Oh, okay.
It's a nice company. I've spoken to them quite a few times now. It's basically, again, it's AI-based. And I think, you know, there may be emerging here, which is the integration of AI into lots of things. It's, you know, I think it's really coming of age. But they're using AI and ultrasound to basically augment the skills of what ultrasound practitioners. They're using it in training. They've got a big partnership with GE Healthcare that makes, you know, it's the basic world leader in ultrasound machines for you know, sort of fetal medicine. You know,
so that must be a huge rubber stamp of this quality of the technology, because GE isn't going to go partner with a small, you know, relatively small company on AIM unless the technology is top notch.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, it works. You know, and I think they, you know, had a tough pandemic because, you know, this is the kind of stuff that depends upon people getting into hospitals. But, you know, a lot of these companies, particularly in the device side of things, sell through by going into hospitals or by going to trade fairs. All of that stuff got shut down. You know, so you know, there was a sort of recovery track there as business returns to normal. But you know, in terms of the technology, it's there. It's good. The question is, at what point does that, you know, hit revenues? So, you know, the GE, the AI enabled technology is a relatively small part of business, and I guess what we want to see is sort of some kind of sales momentum there. They're setting up, you know, direct sales teams in the US. It appears to be working. So it's on the watch list. And I don't mind missing the bottom. I'd like to see something on, you know, that sort of upward momentum. Happy to lose a few percent at the beginning. But yeah, I really do, as I say, like the look of this company. You know, it can extend its technology into other areas, oncology being another one. I think it's moving into sort of the liver scanning at the moment, which is, you know, potentially good news, given everyone, you know, stupid during lockdown.
No, no, and the advantage with the ultrasound is because it is effectively sound, you know, sort of like waves, then it's a lot safer, isn't it, than x-rays. You don't get that problem. And the resolution of these pictures is becoming a far, far better than they've ever been, aren't they?
Yeah, well, what this is doing, it's enabling, you know, practitioners to look in the right place. They use it for anesthesia as well. So I think they've got a thing called needle trainer. So it's basically, you know, basically helping practitioners know how to you know, anesthetists to train them to actually deliver anesthetic in the right place. And you know, all of this stuff bodes well. They call it classroom to clinic. So training people how to use it, and then it gets out in the field. And, you know, those things you would hope at some point really sort of coalesce into a really virtuous circle. I'm not sure we're quite there yet, but it's definitely on the right track. They're raising money, so you know, it's potentially, you know, all uphill from here.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm with you. I think if you go, particularly in the medical devices, go best in class technology, you're usually fine. You can sort out the sort of funding, but it's getting those partners in place and getting your distribution. I mean, another one exactly which fits the bill is Bellascura, and it came up with a trading update that is effectively commercializing its patented and FDA-approved portable oxygen concentrators, and they've got a really big year ahead of them in 2023, and Dowgate are putting out sort of like they're looking to sell 12,000 of these, which frankly, you know, they should be able to do as long as they've got the production for it. And the big Chinese manufacturer is coming on stream in Q1. And as we all know, the problem currently with COVID in China, that they desperately need portable oxygen concentrators, essentially like our ventilation machines, but you can treat these guys at home rather than actually in hospital. So that's coming on stream shortly. And if they can bring that as fast as possible, that's just like so help so many hundreds of thousands of people. And then likewise, you know, the portable oxygen concentrators in developed worlds where people are vaccinated help the COPD and, you know, sort of other sort of respiratory conditions. And there's literally millions and millions of people, in fact, tens and hundreds of millions of people with lung, you know, as we talked about, with lung cancer from smoking, that with COPD. So this is a huge untapped market, and their product set is absolutely best in class. They've got a new next generation version coming out, which is lighter and produces more oxygen than anything else on the market. And the key is basically execution now. But I'm with you. I think the principle when it comes to these sort of things is to go into sort of like, you know, best in class technology.
Yeah, best in class with the cash. And I think what I'm looking for here is that, you know, we know that the pandemic showed that there was massive pressure on healthcare systems around the world. It's interesting you mentioned, you know, China and the need to keep people out of hospital. And I think that is something that is true across any healthcare system. So, you know, we should
be NHS, for instance.
The NHS is the perfect example. Anything that keeps people out of hospital. You know,
you can't get in because you're on an ambulance most of the time.
Well, precisely. So anything to alleviate pressure. Yeah. And actually, there was an interesting little company that had some results this week, Cooth.
Oh yes, yes, you're right. Mental health. Basically software, isn't it? Telemedicine, mental health.
I think that's worth keeping an eye on because you know, agreed. There is without a shadow of a doubt, you know, mental health crisis, not just in the UK but around the world. And you know, health systems are not very well equipped to deal with it. So Cooth potentially offers us a solution that sort of bolts onto health services and uses software, as you say, to really help people with who are suffering from you know some of these mental health conditions, whether it's depression or anxiety or whatever it might be. It's a huge problem. It's a huge problem. And
it's mainly for schools, isn't it? It's mainly for schools, actually, in the UK, which is where it came out, the Heartland. I think it's got a big contract, hasn't it, in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be picking up contracts pace. you know, and I think it's moving into more adult care as well. So
yeah,
I mean, and it pops onto my radar quite recently, but I like the look of that because, as I say, it's really addressing a growing problem that there aren't really, established ways of dealing with.
No, I totally get it, and it's a scalable platform that you can use that science and the expertise which you pick up and develop over. Literally, they've got from my understanding, they'll have a huge database now from having run with people in the UK that they can lift and shift and utilize that and cut and dice and slice it around the world, particularly obviously in English speaking areas like the US, which could do really, really well. And the gross margins on a software telemedicine business probably are quite nice, sort of thought.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to get to the scale. But, as I say, it seems to be growing.
Yeah. Now it's in a good spot, that. Good spot. Another one which came out is Venture Life. And I know we chatted about it a couple of weeks ago, which does over-the-counter sort of niche healthcare products. And I think it's got a trading update coming out towards the end of January. So I'll be looking forward to hearing about that. But they basically, as we talked about, innovation has got to be the heart of all sort of healthcare. And they've just come out with their own sort of like licensed out ulcer, mouth ulcer drugs, which isn't not drugs, basically creams and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but
OTC.
But the margins on these things are fabulous, and they'll do all the manufacturing, and they've licensed out to an expert brand who do sort of like mouth ulcer cream. And I suffer from a bit from Crohn's, so I get lots of these things, so it's pretty useful for me. And then they've increased their distribution as well on a number of other products as well. So the key is basically, if you do have high margin products that are in demand and are niche, is to get the distribution out. And if you can't do it in terms of, being able to put the marketing support into it, get a third party to be able to do it. And they seem to be doing, seem to be sort of like hitting all that. It's quite a good policy, actually, to decide what is your core and what isn't your core, even though you have sort of expertise in areas that you decide not to effectively put your own brand on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another one on the healthcare, we'll just finish on that one, is Avintraz. Now, this is actually a specialist niche.
Healthcare?
Yeah, well, I'd say, it's got, obviously it's bread and butter, is in all things nuclear and defense and big regulated industries, no doubt about it. And it came out with a sort of like a half year trading update saying basically that, the business is well on track. It's got fantastic revenue for visibility of 90% for this year. But it also said that it's just put some money in, because it's got a really strong balance sheet, had about £17 million of cash and is generating plenty of cash. So this is net cash, which is about 50p a share or something. The first bit it deployed was into its healthcare division, fledgling healthcare, Magnetica, which basically is a small form MRI scanners, and it's picked up it's increased its stake from about, I think it was 64% to 71% or 61 to 74, something like that. But it's increased its stake, and that says to me, actually, because they're really quite astute guys, the directors, that they think this has really got a good chance of reaching the market in 2 or 3 years time. So that was good. And then they also bought it was a straight bread and butter bolt on acquisition of a ventilator, basically a HVAC business, small one in the UK. And the idea of that is it's a regulated market, because building sort of regulations for ventilation and for air conditioning and stuff like that is getting better. It has to get better and better. Mm-hmm. So they seem to be very much sort of like on track to deliver.
Yeah, I've always liked, companies selling products into tightly regulated markets, particularly on the engineering side.
Yeah.
And if you look back, quite some way, you had lots of companies like, Halma, Rotork, Spirax, really, really good British engineers that really made their living selling into these markets where, safety was paramount. Where you couldn't cut corners, basically, and there was a time you could pick them up for next to nothing as well.
Yeah,
really high quality companies. They were obviously, their valuations went through the roof, had come back quite a bit. So on the engineering side, D-rated engineers, high quality engineers, I definitely think they're worth a look. Avintraz is not a dissimilar business.
No, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I would class it. I'd class it as a sort of like a super durable long-term grower, actually, because, you know, they've got visibility there and margins for years and years.
Yeah. And I mean, the other one on the engineering side, electrical engineering, Judges Scientific.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Another.
But again, you know, these are all brilliant companies, but the valuation's got really, really hot and they've derated. So, you know, I think if you want to go out there and look around, you know, just look at those really high quality engineers and electrical engineers that have come back in terms of their rating. Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of cyclicality in there, but at the same time, you know, they're supporting all sorts of industries. So there is a bit of a natural sort of hedge against the downside there in a lot of those things.
Yeah, well, I would have thought electrical engineers in particular, because all things are EV, then they're going to be pretty much in demand, you'd have thought, as we sort of migrate to a cleaner environment.
Yeah, well, EVs is something I've been looking at this week, actually.
Okay.
So, I mean, Tesla's had an absolute shocker so far this year. I mean, I think it missed some delivery numbers, slashed its prices, all sorts of trouble. And of course, old Elon is... he's causing a lot of trouble over Twitter, and I do think Tesla shareholders are a bit worried that, you know, his focus has gone. But you know, for me, there's no doubt that the shift to, you know, electrification of transport is happening. And the question, I think, is how you play it. And you know, I've spoken to a couple of companies in the last couple of weeks in the lithium mining space.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
Now,
I understand it. There's about 2 kilograms of lithium in every sort of like Tesla battery, isn't there?
It's massive.
which is enormous.
Yeah. It's the metal. And, you know, there is a structural deficit. You know, there's simply not enough supply in the market. There's, you know, huge amounts of new mines need to be built to just cope with this sort of projected demand for electric vehicles. And there's a few companies in the UK that seem very well positioned to deal with this. One of which I spoke to last week is Atlantic Lithium. And, you know, spoke to the chairman, in fact. The thing I really like about that project, I'm going to put a big caveat on this, by the way. You know, speculative mining is not my thing.
But they've got a big, it's a big sort of like prospective sort of deposit, haven't they? Is it in Ghana? It's in somewhere in Africa, isn't it? I think
Atlantic Lithium is in Ghana. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I thought it was. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know much about it, but that wasn't my understanding. Yeah. And it's coming on stream 24, 25.
24. Which is, you know, that feels a lot quicker than, you know, a lot of the sort of more speculative miners that we've perhaps heard from over the years. And, you know, having spoken to them, a lot of things are in place. You know, a lot of the ingredients are there. You know, the pre-feasibility study looks good. The jurisdiction looks good. They've got the support of the Ghanaian government there. They've got a good partner. And more importantly, the project, you know, is pretty much fully funded, if not fully funded. So you know, it's interesting. Lithium's interesting. Clean tech lithium. Ghana is not, by the way, a big lithium producing jurisdiction yet. You know, the biggest.
It used to be cocoa, didn't it, when I was doing my geography lessons?
Yeah, that would be about right. But you know, they want to go up. They want to increase their, you know, their GDP. They want to be a value added economy. So this is the kind of interesting thing they're moving into, and they want to do it in partnership. You know, the governments there, they don't want to be exploited. They want to. You know, benefit from this, and that appears to be what's happening with Atlantic Lithium. You know, ESG, dirty word though, it's for some, is really high on a lot of miners' agendas these days. They cannot be the exploitative companies that they once were. They work in partnership with locals. You know, a lot of local expertise will be within those companies. So I think it's really interesting. The other guy I spoke to was the chief exec of Cleantech Lithium.
Yeah,
that's out in Chile. And Chile, again, you know, big mining country and massive lithium deposits there. Massive. So, yeah, that is, you know, a little bit further away. But again, a lot of the right ingredients are there. I just think that, again, it's just definitely worth keeping an eye on. You know, it's a market in structural deficit, and the demand is going to go through the roof. These are, you know, critical minerals.
Yeah, no, I must have had a look at the sort of chart of lithium carbonate, and what's called carbonate. What's quite interesting, actually, is that it went from it's about four or five fold compared to it was pre-pandemic, because obviously the transition to electric vehicles, but it hasn't come off like many of the other hard metals like zinc or aluminium or tin or anything like that, which has struggled because of China. This has actually retained its value, you know, hugely, hasn't it, lithium?
Yeah. And, you know, if anything, the price is going to go higher. I think it's a good area of mining to be looking at. And, you know, you do worry about sort of hype cycles and, you know, we've seen it before where, you know, there's a lot of excitement around a particular metal and the price goes through the roof and it comes back down again. But I think there's something more substantial behind the lithium price and the supply and demand fundamentals in that market.
Mm. And with the just moving now to sort of like the earnings coming up, et cetera, just for sort of like, so they've started obviously in the US, but in terms of, you know, England and Europe, et cetera, that'll be over the next month. So what sort of sectors would be sort of good sort of bellwethers? Well, let's start. What about, you know, the banks, et cetera, because they give you a good sort of view of what the economy is doing, don't they? And then perhaps dovetail that with another sector you quite like, which is the sort of like the H&T and the Begbies, the insolvency boys.
Yeah. I mean, we've already seen some numbers from the banks over in the US.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And they were a bit good. Mixed. They were mixed, weren't they? I think it's probably a polite way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean, Goldman missed.
Yes.
I think it was Morgan Stanley hit his numbers, but profits were, you know, 50% of what they were year before. You know, if we see, I mean, all of the UK banks, because I guess that's what, you know, our listeners will be more likely to be invested in. You know, they all do slightly different things. They're all exposed to slightly different areas of market, but you know, if you look at the sort of major lenders, the domestic lenders, Lloyds,
they've rallied a lot now. They're not far from book value, which is surprising because I think they started sort of 3 months ago at 40p, and now they're sort of like 50p as I last saw, or 49. So they're not far from, you know, there's quite a lot of optimism now, Cindy, built in.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is a real classic case of that you know, inflationary cycle versus the recession cycle. You know, so obviously an important way that banks earn money is that sort of net interest margin.
Yes.
And in a low interest, or, you know, ZERP world, low interest rate world, it's hard for them to make money. So an inflationary environment where the response is, you know, from central banks is to raise interest rates, you know, on paper, that makes it easier for them to make money from their loan book. The flip side is that it also means that markets like real estate, which they lend to heavily, you know, it's a very American word. I mean commercial real estate.
Yeah, commercial property. You know,
the housing market, activity potentially softens quite significantly. And we're already seeing that. So
yeah, loan growth goes negative.
Just goes, you know, through the floor. And so basically you've got this balancing act between, oh, we can make more money on our loan book, but the loan book is potentially shrinking because people don't want to take out, or banks just won't lend. You know, they're not comfortable lending. So, you know, if those shares are, as you say, trading close to book value, then where's the value in the sector?
Yeah. What about those insolvency boys? I know you quite like the sort of the other side of the coin. If you've got a darker view about the recession, then the likes of Begbies are going to have a roaring tried.
Yeah, it's a funny one, Begbies, because the shares never seem to do a great deal. They're up 10% over the year. You know, and you think, well, you know, recession is on the way. We see certainly lots of signs that, you know, corporate insolvencies are on the rise. You know, Begbies themselves published this thing called Red Flag Report. You know, and it's been becoming, it's increasingly gloom, you know, business failures or the signs that there may be a wave of business failures on the way are rising. But you know, they never seem to really move on the back of this news. You know, I like it, but I keep looking at it thinking, well, come on, it's got to happen soon. but as I say, it just doesn't seem to happen. But you know, maybe it will. The other one is H&T. Obviously, you know, it's slightly different. H&T,
pawnbroker, isn't it?
For all intents and purposes, is a pawnbroker.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, their numbers recently were, you know, again, people using their services is on the rise. The other thing they're exposed to is the gold price, because obviously a lot of a lot of what gets cashed in is gold. Gold's been also, you know, surprisingly subdued. It's sort of been down and then up, and you know.
Well, I think it tends to inverse relationship with treasury bonds. Yeah, well, treasury yields, isn't it? Because it gives you no carry, and therefore, if the interest rate on you know, you can get under buying a treasury at 4%, then the gold price has little attraction. It will come down.
But if you're expecting some, you know, sort of economic Armageddon. Then there is the idea that gold is a safe haven or an inflation hedge. But you're right, a weakening dollar, you know, and by dint of that, treasuries is good for the gold price. And we are expected to see now, having seen that dollar strength at the end of last year, there is most people are suggesting or forecasting a quite significant reversal. And so, you know, that's potentially good for the gold price. And that's potentially good for someone like HT, who's seeing more people coming through the doors and what they have in their pledge book increase in value because it's gold.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. It should be a good counter-cyclical play, isn't it, really? Sort of cover bases. I'll tell you what, that's also picking up now, and it's been a bit quiet, is the sort of the M&A activity, because certainly before Christmas, one of my stocks, Crestchick, has got sort of like bought out, or has been a bid which will be voted on on the 5th, I think, of February. Yeah.
Interesting one, that. No bidding war?
Yeah. Not yet. Anyway, we'll wait and see. I mean, to be honest, as a shareholder, I'm frankly delighted. And the management team have done a fabulous job of turning this business around over the last 3 years. So I totally tip my hat to them. But it's just quite interesting. There's a couple of hedge funds there who have been picking up shares at around about £4. So they think there is a chance that there's going to be, you know, and a remote chance of somebody putting another bid on it, because these guys don't go around just trying to make one pence out of £4 because the transaction costs don't work. But
I did hear complaints. You know, there were a couple of takeovers or take turning offers at the same time. K3 Capital.
Oh yes, okay, yeah. Justin did well out of that, I think.
He's here, yeah. Was one that popped out one of our stock screens. And again, it's sort of in the, if I'm right, in the sort of insolvency,
legal services,
legal services type space. So, you know, it's kind of well positioned, but there were complaints that, you know, companies were letting themselves go too cheaply.
Well, Seraphine this morning was trading at about 9p, 10p, and then got a bid just this morning for all cash at 30. Admittedly, it's a lot less than it was sort of its IPO at £2, but even so, it just shows you that actually there is people are picking, you know, sort of assets off the market quite quickly, aren't they?
Yeah. There was another one I noticed got bid for. Again, it was something that popped out of our stock screens, but it's a company I've liked to look at for some time, and that was Devro.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the sausage guys, aren't they?
Sausage skins.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Exciting world of collagen casings.
That's right. Yeah.
But yeah, they got a bid, 50% premium. And
yeah,
that's what you want to see. You know, that sort of premium is what you want to see. Because, you know, the UK market, particularly at the smaller end, it has derated quite significantly. There is every risk that, this is a happy hunting ground for overseas predators.
Yeah.
I think there was a report this week. Jamie Constable from Singer and I spoke about it. But the UK's attractiveness as an investment destination has gone through the roof. I think PwC conducted a report. It's now the third most attractive global investment destination. You wouldn't think that, given, you know, if you live here.
but it's cheap. The value is just there, isn't it? You just got to look at the headline. The FTSE 100 was flat last year, but the small caps AIM was down 30%. So that level of 30% underperformance is just totally off the charts. It's totally extreme. And I think the small cap index trades at roughly around about 10 or 11 times forward, you know, earnings. If you strip out the loss, you know, the real sort of like the loss making ones, and just look at the ones that are profitable. So it's real value there, no doubt about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's been a horrendous derating. It's something I discussed this morning, actually, with Scott Evans, who of London Business School, who compiles the numerous smaller companies index. There has been a horrific derating, particularly at the small cap end this year.
Mm.
You know, and particularly some of the sort of higher growth companies that were more exposed to kind of rising interest rates. You know, obviously, we know the mechanism, the value of future cash flows decreases, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of rich pickings out there. And, you know, what Scott concludes, and it's the videos up on Vox, is that actually, you know, the number of what they call fallen angels, companies that have fallen, you know, into the lower value index is at one of the highest levels it's ever been. And when we've seen periods where this has happened before, and I think he points to 1975, which followed a horrific bear market, 73, 74, and 2009, which obviously followed the credit crunch, they were the years in which small caps went absolutely gangbusters.
Mm.
And so the big question is this that year? And as you say, looking at those, that massive derating and the potential for overseas bidders, or just, you know, anyone you know, looking for value. And actually the question then is, well, actually a lot of growth stocks are in value territory now as well.
Yeah, Tesla.
Yeah. Or, you know, big tech, big US tech, you know.
Yeah. Facebook. You know,
we could see some real outperformance next year, but M&A might be part of what's behind it.
Yeah, no, I'm just finishing on that one. I mean, I had another one in my portfolio, which got a bid, which was quite attractive, which was Amrit Pharma, which we used to be on AIM, but has actually moved out to NASDAQ and was trading at about $7 per share, got a bid for $14.50 off a Italian pharmaceutical company. So again, it just shows if you go to best-in-class technologies with good sound balance sheets, good management teams and defensible sort of like, you know, products and services, then if they're trading cheap, you can almost guarantee somebody's going to have a good look at it, because it's an easy one for the acquirer's board to approve, because you get a guaranteed earnings stream. Plus, you know what the synergies you're going to get because you've worked that out on the cost side. You know what price, and therefore it's a lower risk deal rather than buying something where you've got to turn it around.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I think the UK is not well known for tech. You know, we don't have the wealth of tech that they do over in the US, but what we do have, you know, appears to be really good quality. So,
yeah,
you know, I had a good chat this morning with John Prideaux, the chief executive of Boku, which is the
the
mobile billing company.
Yeah, they're really sort of shooting a blaze, aren't they? In terms of, I think it's out in Asia, isn't it? They do a lot
big
of the
big part of business is out in Asia. They're sort of shifting the model to.
Yeah.
So it was direct carrier billing. So you basically build your e-commerce purchase through your mobile bill. They're moving to local payment gateways. So you know, it's a business in transition. But what they expect to see at the end of it, you know, is a much more valuable proposition. They've just signed a massive deal with Amazon.
Have they?
Massive deal with Amazon. Hasn't even kicked off yet. Not even in the numbers. You know, that's expected to kick off soon. You know, expect some news flow this year. But I'm, you know, in terms of quality tech, you know, that would fall into that bracket. There's another company I've been keeping my eye on, but only because, you know, I use it.
Oh, yeah.
And I hadn't realized it was listed, but it's a company called Auction Technology Group.
Oh, yes, I know. Yeah.
Yeah, wasn't, you know, it's not really very high profile. It's very, very strange. But I, you know, I'm in auction land out here in Suffolk, so
okay.
So I've been enjoying the online auctions. It took me a while to sort of put two and two together, and this is the company powering it. It's fantastic technology. You know, you think about an auction where you've got, you know, room bidders and web bidders, you know, and that thing cannot go wrong. It has to be, you know, super real time. There can't be any latency, any delay in it. That technology is fantastic, and what they've got is a group of sites that take, you know, gives them presence in the UK, Europe, US, art and antiques, commercial. You know, it's a really, really interesting company. And I'm just looking at the valuation. So for a tech company,
not, if I remember, I mean, I had a look at it and it's not cheap, but it's the highest quality recurring revenue stream type business, isn't it? Because it's a platform that generates super normal sort of like operational gearing.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, it's 24 times earnings looking here. So no, I really like it. And I think, again, they're at that point, that inflection point where this potentially, you know, really starts, the numbers really
start. It's not a small business though, is it? It's pretty big already.
No, getting towards a billion.
Yeah.
And still growing fast. And, you know, it's the kind of stuff that does well in a recession as well. People start, you know, putting a lot of stuff through auctions, you know, secondhand goods rather than new. So yeah, I've got my eye on that. I do like it. And then in the UK, I think we've got a fantastic fintech sector, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, so you know, we've got companies like Fintel, TrueFin, You know, augmented fintech on the sort of investment company side. You know, we're world leaders in fintech over here. So
yeah, I think Argentex is another one, which is basically it's got a trading update coming out in the next couple of weeks. So that'll be quite interesting to watch out for.
Yeah, definitely fintech should be on everyone's watch list.
All right, bro. Well, thanks very much for your time, John, and look forward in chatting again in the near future.
Absolutely. All good fun.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.